everyone. Thank you for coming. We didn't expect so many people, so thank you, Kirrawee people, for coming along. It just shows you the interest is fantastic. I'm going to hand over to Peter Kay, and he's going to introduce Beau, who is giving the presentation tonight. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. As you know, the subject is Kirrawee District tonight. I was speaking to someone not very long ago, and they were saying, well, where is Kirrawee? So for those that don't know, for the sake of probably the one person that doesn't know, from Ruakākahu, 20 kilometres inland along Kirrawee Road, the Kirrawee District begins. And Beau will tell you the history of Kirrawee. The map that we've got in front of you is one of the stations, Paparangi Station. Kirrawee was made up of four stations in the early days, around about that period of time. Ruakākahu Station went right up to Kirrawee, almost to Kirrawee. Orig Station went right to Kirrawee. And if you're looking for more information, Heydays and Draydays was written by Mr. Patterson, who owns Orig Station, and that's a mine of information on the historical side. It's particularly Orig, but it does incorporate a lot of the Kirrawee. A year ago we had our centenary, a school centenary. We combined it as a district and school centenary, and prior to that we decided that it'd be quite good to make some sort of presentation, and we got hold of Beau here, and Beau agreed to write the history of Kirrawee. We sold out of these, but if anybody was interested, we can do a rerun, so if you wanted to, I could take your name and address, and so long as we've got a reasonable number of books ordered, we can order a copy for you. There is one in the library here, and that's for a reference, as a reference book. I'd like to introduce Beau Jarman. She's a member of the Kirrawee District. She's written this book. She's a mine of knowledge of the Kirrawee District, and there were going to be slides and all that sort of stuff, but Beau was told that it actually gets through a little bit easier by having a talk and then answering questions afterwards. So I'll leave it up to you, Beau. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not a historian. My qualifications are in social anthropology, so my talk will lapse into an anthropological phase at some stage. As Peter said, the district was formed from four very large stations in the early days. The major one in terms of Kirrawee District was Paparangi, the one that we have the map here for. Paparangi was the first. It began in 1856, and it was on the western side of the Paparangi stream. It grew even more when the Powderals, who were on the other side of the stream, sold. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The next to start was Kirrawee Station, then Oru, and then Whanakino. All of those stations were around about 20,000 acres. We're told that Paparangi started when James Lyon, who was part of the firm Lyons and Blair in Wellington, bought the land. The son of the owner ran the land, and you get a funny picture of one man, because everyone says so-and-so bought this land and he farmed it. The reality is that he may not have done anything at all. You can't farm a property of that size without either machinery or manpower. There wasn't machinery in those days, there were men. When you think back to the time that this was happening, there were great problems with the Maori further north. There was the Maori King movement. There were hauhau. There was great difficulty for settlers in New Zealand. So England sent out fencible soldiers. There were at least 100 soldiers sent to our district. What do they do when they're not being soldiers, when they're not under attack? They work on farms. If you have enough money to buy a big station, you also have enough money to employ not only people to work the land, you have people who can work in the household. So they had servants. So instead of one man buying a property and farming it, yes, he did do that. Did he do all the work? No, not in those days. I told you that some Powderals were living on the other side of the stream. Their property was called Brown Lodge. Ostensibly, it was owned by two brothers, but they had the rest of their family there. They didn't stay for very long, and William Nelson, who has been called the father of Hastings, was a farm cadet at Kereru Station, and he used to visit with the Powderls very frequently. They played cards, they had morning and afternoon teas together, they did all sorts of things together. The Powderls' farm, their house was here, and it wasn't very far for them to walk to Kereru Station, which is the next block. William Nelson bought the Powderl block, and his brother Frederick came down from Auckland to join him, and they built a very large and beautiful house and then sold it. William had decided that he was going to come into New Hastings. He was interested in refrigeration of meat. He could see that that was the future for New Zealand. So he left, and his brother Frederick stayed until the land was sold, and the land was sold to the Lions. So Paparangi expanded onto both sides of the stream, and the house was so beautiful that it became the homestead for Paparangi. Paparangi is where I live. I live on that farm, and it's the most wonderful place on earth for me. It has fantastic views. The house was absolutely beautiful, but in 1925 it was pulled down and replaced with an architecturally designed house, and it is still there and lived in by the current owners. In 1875, the Lions had sold the property to some gentlemen from Christchurch and Dunedin, who were joined by another gentleman from the Deep South, a Scot named John Anderson. Anderson bought out most of his partners and moved up to stay at Paparangi. He was 12 years old when he had left Scotland with his parents, and they had settled in Otago and built a wonderful station there where they farmed merino sheep. While they were in Otago, one of John's sisters was married to a gentleman who had come out as a widower with a young daughter from Glasgow, and the guy's name was Matthew Miller, for whom Miller Street in Hastings is named. Matthew had married John Anderson's sister Elizabeth. I think they had 13 children, 11 of whom survived. But Matthew came up to Hawke's Bay and started up a stock and station agency and started buying as much land as he could lay his hands on. He obviously had the money, and he persuaded his brothers-in-law and his father-in-law to buy lots and lots of land in the area. So he was the first one to purchase any land in Kereru. He was also the person who bought land which was absolutely useless, which was taken up by a pair of brothers by the name of Duff, Hugh and Alec Duff. And in those days, they used to use a method called spotting. So if there was a piece of land that wasn't any use, you didn't buy it. So the shape of their property was most peculiar. So Matthew Miller bought the useless bits of land to try and force the Duff brothers out. But the Duff brothers, also canny Scots, decided that they would fence their bits of land and then ask the neighbours for the money to be share of the fencing. That didn't work. So he was throwing money around right, left and centre, which ultimately was his downfall. He was apparently a very, very interesting character. He had a wonderful home. He entertained lavishly, but he put so much money into land that when the crash of the 1890s arrived, he went completely bust. When he died, there was nothing left. But he had made so many good friends. The friends bought a house, and they had been to the auction of all of his property. They bought it back, and they filled the house with all of his things and presented it to his wife. He was so popular. So when you're in Miller Street next, think of him. Now, Kereru was really begun in 1857. when J.N. Williams bought the property. After several years, he went into partnership with Colonel Jasper Herrick, one of these soldiers that had been around. Herrick was the man who farmed Kereru. Williams lived on his Frimley property. Colonel Herrick must have been a really good farmer because many people went to stay at Kereru as farm cadets to learn how to do sheep farming. And his wife died in childbirth. I believe she was having twins, which was absolutely devastating for him. She was buried on the property at the place where she used to sit and wait for him to come home at night. Not very long afterwards, Jasper Herrick sold up his share of the property and bought at Onga Onga, or near to Onga Onga. Matthew Miller had a field day for a couple of years, selling Kereru over and over and over again, three times. So he must have made quite a bit on commission. The property was bought by the Hardings of Mount Vernon near Waipukurau, and the son farmed the property for about 28 years, I think. Old work was begun a couple of years after Kereru. A young 21-year-old Hector Pope Smith, sailed for New Zealand, a four-month trip by sailing ship. He was a Scot. He had a lot of money for those days, a great deal of money. He investigated New Zealand. He went to the South Island. All Scots go to the South, don't they, when they start off? But he didn't decide until he'd seen further. Thought it was a bit cold. Went to Auckland, found it too expensive there. Wound up in the Hawke's Bay and ideal climate. So he originally bought just 2 miles away from Mulai Kakahu Station. His place was originally called Aorangi. And if you know the area, when Kereru Road goes through Mulai Kakahu, it forks. It's a three-way fork. To the right, you've got Aorangi Road, and if you keep bearing left, you're on Kereru Road still. That's where he built his homestead and the main farm buildings. He didn't stay in New Zealand for terribly long. He was restless. But obviously, he had people working there and doing the clearing and whatever else was needed. He went back to Scotland and met the woman that he wanted to marry, but his mother was against it, so he came back to New Zealand still single. A couple of years later, he went back, married Anne Barron, despite his mother's disapproval, and for several years they stayed and had three sons before they came back to New Zealand. They had two more sons and a girl. They had a lot of tragedies. The house that was built and done up for them was burnt down before they could move in. And then the biggest tragedy of all, Anne died. She'd had their last child. The doctor used unsterilized instruments at the delivery. She developed septicemia and she died. He was devastated. 6 months later, he died too, at the age of 41. So the six children were taken back to Scotland to be raised. They were taken back by the Duff brothers. The Duffs were cousins of the Smiths. In 1865, they had bought some land right up close to the ranges, and that was the beginning of Bakawara Station, the one that they had spotted and they'd had the fighting with Matthew Miller. John Anderson then arrives on the scene, buys out all of his partners except a man named Royce, who's in the South Island and has nothing to do with the property. He does a deal with the Duffs. They come to an agreement as to who is going to have what piece of land. It still winds up a most peculiar shape in both cases, but that's okay. And we've got the four stations. The Smith children are in Scotland being raised. They're there for 10 years, and then the three oldest boys come back to New Zealand and they go to Kereru Station to learn how to be sheep farmers. James goes back to Scotland, and he's the eldest. Then the government steps in. they want to break up some of these big properties, and because James, being the eldest, is an absentee landlord, you Smiths don't need all of that land. So the government, it's Richard Seddon's government, they take all of the established part with the existing buildings, so they lose about 6,000 acres, and they're left with 14,000 acres. So Charles and Hector divide it up. Charles calls his part Ulrich, and Hector calls his Whanakino. Some of the land has to be sold when Charles dies at the age of 39. It's a really sad family. There's always something nasty happening. So the trustees are forced to sell some land, and then later on some more. So we start to get the smaller farms from the Ulrich properties. Anderson, meanwhile, on Pokarangi, is doing very nicely, thank you. He was one of the presidents of the Hawke's Bay AMP show. He was very well known and respected as a judge of sheep in particular. Most people in those days farmed merino. Anderson used to go to Australia once a year to buy more stud rams. I think he sounded like a really lovely person. I got very fond when I was doing the research of a number of characters from those early days. One of the characters from Pokarangi Station, who was one of these soldiers, was a man named William Whitnell, who lived right at the back of the station in a hut which is now known as Ellis Hut or Murderer's Hut, but it was built for him. He was quite a character. He spent months and months on his own and used to get rather funny ideas in his head. Once when the hands from the station went up to muster the sheep, they found Bill Whitnell racing round and round and round on a track that he'd cut from the bush on his horse, which he had decided was a wonderful, wonderful nag, and he was going to enter her in the next lot of Kiriru races, which used to happen out on those properties. And he was very angry when these other shepherds arrived, because they were spying on him and checking up on his horse, and if they didn't get out too sweet, he was going to lift his rifle and take a pot shot at them. But they persuaded him to come back to the station with them and calmed him down. And one day, he'd been celebrating in town and so far forgot himself as to say, "I have a title, you know." Somebody checked up, and he did. He was Sir William Whitnell. So you actually never knew who or what some of these people were going to be. John Anderson died in 1905, but the family kept going. One son, the eldest son, had run the property until ill health stopped him. Two sons went to the Boer War. One of them didn't come back. Only one of his daughters married, and she married a shepherd who'd been working on the property. And there were two sisters, Christina and Elizabeth, who was known as Bessie, and a brother named Robert, who'd had an accident and was in a wheelchair. They were the ones who had the house revamped, and there was a special downstairs room for Robert, and I think he had his own bathroom as well. They had servants. The house originally had bells, and when the place was sold after World War II and it was taken over by Lands and Survey, the manager and his family lived in the house. And I've talked to the three little girls who lived there then, and they said, "We used to ring the bells, but nobody ever came." They wouldn't have dared not come when Mrs. Anderson was around. She was an absolute martinet, and there were ads in the paper after the First World War for staff for Pokarangi, but apparently she was quite demanding. The family sold after World War II because with the wars the staff left. Obviously the men went to war, and huge parts of the property just had to be left. They couldn't be controlled. So we get the beginning of scrub regrowth and rabbits, a dreadful plague of rabbits. Whanakino was suffering from erosion because they burnt off huge parts of the property and the rabbits came in and took over. There were even times when stock was dying for lack of feed because the rabbits got there first. So they had to have rabbiters. After World War One, soldiers came back not the same as they had been before they left. And I think that's true for every war. We're only now realising the effect of war on men who've had to participate. So we start to get some characters arriving. Now, there was a man named Alexander Shute who came back from the war. He'd been severely wounded in the abdomen, and I think the whole process of war had affected him quite badly. And he decided he wanted to live in the back country and he was going to be a rabbiter. So he came out and he serviced Kereru, Big Hill Station, which was a break-off from Kereru Station, and parts of Pokarangi. He had a huge pack of dogs of different breeds, and he killed many thousands of rabbits. He boiled up the skins in wattle bark, and then the laborious process of scraping them with pumice stone for ages. He could be seen sometimes riding stark naked around the property. I don't know what the ladies thought, there weren't that many of them. And he was great friends with the head shepherd from Pokarangi, a man named Andy Pearson, who also worked at Kereru. They were also friends with Sydney Smith, who was raised on Pokarangi Station. Rumour had it in the district that he was the son of one of the Anderson girls. I interviewed a man who had done a lot of work on all of the stations in the area recently. And I said, "Do you remember Sydney Smith?" And he said, "Oh, ratbag." His official job was chauffeur. He spent a lot of his time making and drinking home brew, which didn't always work. One lot apparently got fed to the pigs, and then the resultant antics of the pigs had everybody in stitches. Why he was a chauffeur, goodness knows, because he often landed up in the ditch. In 1943, the district was asked to host American Marines who had been fighting at Guadalcanal and were somewhat shell-shocked. Well, two of them were allocated to Pokarangi. They were even more shell-shocked when they got there because Sydney had been deputed to pick them up, which he did, but he'd spent the afternoon in the pub. So by the time they got there, they were terrified. They had dinner, and after dinner, Miss Bessie played the organ, and as they were going upstairs to their bedroom, she started to play the Dead March from Saul, which terrified them even more. So much so that the next morning, they hightailed it off to Whanakino because they were too afraid to stay at Pokarangi, not knowing what was going to happen next. Another character was Andy Pearson. Now, he went right through into the 1950s. He was the head shepherd. Apparently, in the early days, he used to do docking with his teeth. But by the time the white girls knew him, he didn't have any teeth. And apparently, he could eat anything, even without teeth. He was apparently a wonderful shepherd, always in a hurry. And he was a great friend of Alex Shute, the rabbiter, and Sid Smith, the chauffeur. And many a trip to Tikakino pub and not managing to get back was quite something. I've gone over time.
No.
I'd better get back to Kereru. After the Hardings, the place was bought by a descendant of the Scottish outlaw Rob Roy MacGregor. Was bought by a man named Robert Turnbull. Now, when he left Scotland, he had bought in Otago, and he'd actually bought two stations there, and he'd done extremely well. He sold them, came north, and bought Kereru Station. Now, he was 70 years old at this stage. He tried to farm the place as he had farmed in the South Island, and it didn't work. It was horrible. You can't plough too early in spring in Kereru because you lose your topsoil. And that's exactly what happened to him. He had a son named Montague, Monty for short, who wanted to join the army and whose mother didn't want him to. But then World War One broke out. Monty worked his way over to England, joined the army, was posted to Egypt as a major, and when he got there, he joined the Royal Flying Corps and learned to fly. He had married a nurse named Cora, mother did not approve, and she joined him in Egypt. In 1917, he was shot down, taken prisoner by the Turks, and he had a terrible leg injury during all of this. It turned horribly septic, and it looked as if he would have to lose the leg. But an Armenian surgeon happened to be around and said, "I can save that." And he did. And they became lifelong friends, always kept in contact. So he always had to wear a heavy bandage on his leg, but it didn't stop him being a great golfer. They came back, he and his wife, in 1919, and after a couple of years of readjusting, he took over running the farm, or trying to. But his father kept on interfering, and his mother kept on interfering in the marriage. It just got really, really difficult. So they only had one son, and after about 15 years further from that, the marriage broke up. Monty was later to become the secretary of the Wauhook Golf Club. His father died at the age of 90, a disappointed man. He really hadn't made a go of Kereru. And Kereru was then bought by granddaughters of Charles Nelson, the Nelson sisters, and they ran the property and revived it, and it is still run by the trustees. They set up trusts, and it is still run by the trustees, so there's always a manager there. Whanakino, that was farmed by the Duffs, by Hugh Duff. Hugh Duff Jr. was killed in World War II. The property was then run by trustees until the daughter came back from England with her husband, Mr. Eaton, and they ran the property until 1957, where most of it was sold to the government and is in forestry, and there was about 500 acres left that's still farmed today by other people. So that's a potted history of Kereru District. But as Peter told you, there's great books. Dick Patterson's books are extremely good. There's one on William Nelson, and there's Heydays and Dreydays, and there's my little book that I did for the school. And the other ones that you should read are the little books by Lester Masters. They are absolutely brilliant. And he was another character who worked on all of those properties, but he collected stories from the inhabitants, and he was well known for his habit of taking two cigarette papers, filling them really, really thick with tobacco, and then sitting there with a fag hanging out of his mouth, writing down the stories from the early settlers. Nobody told him that smoking stunts your growth, obviously, because he's quite short, wasn't he, Bob?
Well, tell me, who's got a memory like that without reading notes? So we're going to open for questions, and I hope, Peter, you can answer some too.
Can I just add a little bit? I've just been making one or two notes while Bo's been talking, and yeah, we're not all loonies and drunkards coming out of Kereru. That's just the highlight of some of the stories. Poperinghe, that map that you see there is now 16 farms plus a large part of the Gravis Forest.
But I just want to say on behalf of Landmarks, what a wonderful talk to finish the year. We've now recorded as many talks as we can, and they're being held with the agreement of the speakers, both here, and a copy is going through to the Knowledge Bank. So it's just wonderful that these locals are building up this wonderful history, which is being constantly put away. Thank you, Bowens. The most fantastic talk for someone without referring to notes. And how wonderful that the area had you to do their history for the school centenary. So thank you all.